Welcome everybody to Art of Advisory. This is episode 7. We'll be talking about unsolicited advice. Welcome, Kirk. How are you?
I'm good, Hector. What's going on in your world?
Well, it's tax season. I don't know how you feel about that word or expression, but it's just busy. Busy in a really, really good way. And by the way, I'll do a side note, something I learned a couple of years ago. When anyone asks you, how are you doing and you're busy, saying busy is probably the worst thing you can say, because people will automatically put their rail guards up and think, oh, does that mean that I can't talk to you? Does that mean that we have to end our conversation briefly? Does that mean that you don't have time for me? Does that mean that that big project I wanted you to do, I probably not going to give it to you because you're too busy for it? So busy is, it's good word because it makes you feel, it makes you feel that you're telling them you're important to a lot of people, but it actually has a whole bunch of negative connotations. So I am always open to taking new wonderful clients, and I happen to be just very involved in a lot of projects. Let's call it that. Without saying,
you're working with a lot of great people at the moment, is what you mean, right?
Absolutely.
I find with accountants and bookkeepers, the phrase "it's tax season" is simply the industry accepted way to say I'm busy without offending anyone.
Yeah, no, sure. Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to start, Kirk, and I think we had a lot of fun last week kind of dissecting and psychoanalyzing the concept of leaving money on the table. So I like to use another expression that we use a lot in our day-to-day lingo, and we probably don't pay much attention to why we use it or what it doesn't mean, is the expression unsolicited advice. What does that mean, Kirk? What does unsolicited advice mean?
Well, if you break it down, you know, it's a compound term, right? Unsolicited is the first word. Advice is the second. Unsolicited, I think we can all relate to that. We get a lot of that every day, whether it's junk mail that comes in your mailbox, telemarketing phone calls, or somebody knocking on your door wanting to tell you about the latest, you know, cable, TV, or internet provider. Those are all unsolicited. Somebody who you didn't ask to talk to them. They initiated it, so it was unsolicited. You did not extend to them any invitation to tell you or ask you anything. Advice, of course, is the connotation that you're going to offer some type of wisdom, experience, knowledge that the other person either has not had or doesn't have access to that's going to benefit them. Some piece of information that's going to move them forward by learning what it is you have to share with them. So essentially, it is knowledge you did not ask for. Now, sometimes that can be received well, sometimes not so much. I think just by the term unsolicited, we're implying that it's probably not going to be received really well if somebody didn't extend an invitation to you. In other words, you don't have a relationship with them.
You know, one of the unsolicited advice that I always get, and I know my dad is probably watching this because he watches everything that I do, and I appreciate his support, is when my parents give me unsolicited advice on how to parent my children. And I think that happens to almost everyone, right? Where, you know, their parents who went through the same thing that you're going through observe, you know, some sort of behavior with you and your kids. And in some cases, they'll pull you to the side and say, hey, I disagree with the way you manage this and you should do it this way. Or in some cases, they'll do it right in front of the kids and potentially undermine something that you're doing. And in some cases, they're right. Some cases, they're wrong. In some cases, we don't know because it's just up to the psychologist to determine. But what I like to think about, Kirk, and I'm sure it happened to you at some point, and it happens to you with maybe you inadvertently say that to your friends while they're, you know, disciplining their kids or whatever. That is one area where a lot of people are highly sensitive about, right? Like, I think most folks don't want that unsolicited, not necessarily unwelcomed, because I like to separate the difference between unsolicited and unwelcomed. All the advice from my parents is always welcomed, right? So I'll make that open. And even from my friends that have experience with their kids, for example, none of it is unwelcomed, but a lot of times it's unsolicited. And what ends up happening is when unsolicited advice is given, and that advice happens to maybe contradict some of your actions, I think it puts the other person's on the defense automatically. And if the other person's on the defense, that other person, instead of receiving the advice, they may just look for justification as of why your actions differed from that advice, or will automatically go on that, you know, in some sometimes gentle way, sometimes not the gentle way, is, hey, I don't need your advice at the moment, or this is not the right time, or maybe later. So it basically creates a real big consternation on the relationship, and it doesn't achieve anything. What are your thoughts around that? So we're not talking about business yet, and I like to evolve this to a business conversation, but this is one of the most human elements of advisory and how we receive that advice.
It's interesting that you distinguish between unwelcome and unsolicited. The first thing that occurred to me when you mentioned that was simply that, you know, the first context you referred to was your parents, you know, and for most of us, we have a good relationship with our parents. We enjoy talking to them. You know, we don't dodge their phone calls, those kind of things. I remember, I think I heard this off of Dave Ramsey, and I can't remember the exact phrase, but he basically says something like, once somebody's wiped your bottom, they have no interest in what you have to tell them. And that's basically flipping it around, because we also, you know, at the age that you and I are probably sometimes in a position to offer advice to our parents, again, whether it's welcomed or unsolicited. I think unsolicited is simply you didn't ask for it. Unwelcome then kind of goes to the next step of, is that something that you're receptive to or not? So I think unwelcome talks about, are you receptive, where unsolicited talks about, did you offer an opportunity for them to give advice? Did you ask for it or not? I think that's really the distinction that we're making. On a personal level, you're right. It does put somebody on the defensive. And I think that boils down to really a core concept of, we're much more receptive to someone asking us a question than telling us something. And a lot of times these situations, we can approach it differently if we can somehow phrase a question. In fact, I'm actually reading a book right now. The title of it's called Humble Inquiry. And the thesis of the book is this idea that we need to learn how to ask questions in a humble manner that actually are helpful. That instead of telling somebody, we figure out how to turn it around and phrase it as a question. And so, yeah, you're right. How people receive it, that welcome versus unwelcome idea, I think boils down to, do they feel like they're being put on the defensive? Are they reacting defensively? And so much of that comes through in whether it's telling or asking.
You know, it's called Humble. What was the name of the book?
Humble Inquiry.
Okay, I'm putting here on my Amazon.
Or inquiry, depending on how you like to pronounce it.
Definitely going to read that. There was a book that I read, which is similar. It's called Getting Naked by Patrick Lencioni. And so search that inside Amazon. Don't search it in a regular Google search, because you know, you're not going to get the desired results. But it's called Getting Naked. And what it talks about being vulnerable as a consultant. This is kind of a business fable of a business consultant that's going to work with different clients. And it's saying about, you know, whether you should come in from a place of authority and knowledge and experience and state the facts and state, you know, where, you know, your ideas on what you should do to fix the business or move in whatever direction, or should you get naked, right? And be completely vulnerable, walk in with very naive type of questions, and allow that naive inquiry, which is exactly what you're talking about, to plant the seed on the person's head on whether or not they're taking the right direction without you telling them that they're doing the right thing or the wrong thing. You know, going back to the parenting thing, you know, I'm sure that my parents would be much more effective at, you know, instead of telling me, hey, don't tell him that, to, hey, you think that a choice of a different word would it giving you a different reaction, which is the same thing, right? They're giving me advice on how to talk to my kids. But the way you frame the approach can existentially change the behavior on the other person by not coming from a place of contradiction or authority, or you should be listening to me, or I know more than you. Instead of, you know, sort of like flipping it around, it's kind of like the principles of coaching. Like I never really studied coaching as a whole, but I have some friends that I know that studied coaching, and they were explaining to me how coaching works. And I was trying to understand what's the difference between coaching and consulting. And basically they were telling us that I didn't even know that coaching was something you could study, but apparently there's techniques for coaching, and all coaching is drive the person to make the decision on their own simply by being there to sort of be in their guardrails and their thought process and using humble inquiry, naive questions, coming from a place of ignorance, complete ignorance when asking the questions, so the person doesn't feel that you're attacking, their decision making. You're more, giving them options in terms of the, making choices inside their head of what they should do. But you're basically, you are being the catalyst for giving them more options. You're expanding their internal horizon so they can have options when decision making, not necessarily you telling them what to do or what they're doing is wrong.
Yeah, the term naive inquiry is not something, at least on first glance, I'm real comfortable with, because at least the term naive, some people perceive it as negative, I guess would be the best way to say it, uneducated or whatever. I don't think what we're talking about is necessarily that we approach someone truly uneducated. We haven't done any preparation. We haven't put any thought into it. I think it's more the idea of we don't show up assuming that we know the answer. In fact, one of the things that I've said publicly when I've given talks and also to my clients is, if you came to me looking for great answers, you came to the wrong place. What I have is great questions. And I've actually made it a personal habit to study and seek out great questions, to constantly be open to, when I hear somebody ask a question in a new way, to take note of it and to think about, okay, how can I incorporate that into my vocabulary? Humble inquiry really means that we're putting a lot of thought into how we approach somebody. We're not necessarily showing up already with the answer. We've talked previously, that diagnosis without, or prescription without diagnosis is malpractice, right? Deciding what somebody needs before you really get to know them and really go through a process of inquiry is actually wrong. And, doctors and lawyers actually can get in trouble for that. As consultants, we can't. So we've got to hold ourselves to our own code of ethics. That's really what we're talking about. Being able to show up and have a conversation in a way that doesn't put somebody on the defensive, but helps guide them, helps facilitate. We use a term called a Sherpa. A Sherpa comes from the area around Mount Everest, where the people that are native to that area that guide climbers, from most of them from the West up Mount Everest, are called Sherpas. They know that area. They've lived there. They've made many ascents up and down the mountain. They know how to survive at high altitude. They know about the freezing temperatures, the weather changes, all those various things. It's that type of idea. We want to be a Sherpa, whether it is in a personal or a business context. So that's that idea of humble inquiry. We accept that to ask is better than to tell, and we do it in a way that tries to build rapport and build a relationship, but we're being intentional about it, not being unintentional, but being very intentional, but in a way that's genuine.
Yeah, so I agree with you. I think naive is probably the wrong word to use. I was trying to just use another adjective so we don't say the same thing. But you're right. Humble is probably the perfect concept. Now, there was a specific reasoning on why the author of this book, Getting Naked, said that you should take that approach. And it was because there are three fundamental fears that all advisors or consultants or professionals have when coming into a client with inquiry or consulting work. Those three fears are fear of losing business, fear of being embarrassed, and fear of being inferior or feeling inferior. And it's those three fears that drive that consultant or advisor to, instead of using humble inquiry with what you're saying, we try to use statements of fact, you should do this, right? Or go straight into the strategic element of advisory, which is this is the path you should take, this decision you should take. And sometimes we think that our clients hire us only and ultimately so we can make decisions for them. And that's actually far from the truth. You know, and I think a lot of advisors, even myself, the more we can charge or the more we get paid, we almost feel like subconsciously that, hey, you know, since I'm getting paid a lot of money and the client is placing a lot of trust in me, is placing a lot of, you know, making a big investment in my involvement with their business, I should be involved in making decisions with them and for them and being part of the, you know, the mechanics of the day-to-day, you know, strategic execution. And we probably take the wrong approach. And it's because of that fear of losing the business. Like, you know, if I don't give them the right answer, they won't hire me. Or if I ask a question that's quote unquote a stupid question, or that I think it may sound like a stupid question, am I going to be embarrassed? Or if I don't come from a place of seniority and knowledge, you know, am I going to feel inferior? Is the client, the client will feel that they know more than me and therefore they don't need me. So it's Patrick Lencioni, the author, says that if you can get over those three fears and completely forget that they exist, then you completely transform your own approach walking into the client for any advisory, any consulting, you know, whatever type of engagement we have with your client in which they're paying you for your opinion.
Well, I agree with the author on those three fears, because it really is an internal issue. You cannot put yourself into a state where you can help somebody else until you have dealt with your own internal issues that could get in the way of helping them. And a lot of times those fall under the category of being selfish or having an ego or being uncomfortable, lack of self-esteem, self-confidence. You know, we could talk all around those different terms or words, but it all boils down to those things. There needs to be an inner peace, an inner confidence. You need to reach out from a place that says, just because I'm asking a question doesn't signal that in some way I am weaker, lower in status, that because I don't know the answer. I've actually gotten very comfortable walking into situations and love asking questions. And again, you know, when somebody essentially, sometimes people will even say to me, I don't understand why you're asking these questions, or how come you don't already know? And I'll say, look, I'm a consultant. Everything I do by nature is custom. And so I have to ask questions. For me to rush into a situation and presume I know the answer or to try to tell you, that's just breaking all types of rules or guidelines, if you will, for good personal communication in a business or a personal context. But also, it's not putting myself and helping the other party put themselves into a position to be helped. In fact, the author of Humble Inquiry wrote a previous book called Helpful. And one chapter in that book was called Humble Inquiry. And based on writing that book about what do you have to do to be helpful to somebody else? Kind of how do you deal with your personal issues? How do you communicate? What's your personal state? All of that. He drew out of that book a whole nother book based on that one chapter. And so I totally agree. We've got to deal with that internal mess. You know, and sometimes the customer's approach to us can trigger that internal mess, right? Have you ever had, you know, sometimes you have a customer who comes to you very calm and they're willing to go through that conversation, or it can be personal. I know we're trying to keep this neutral, but I can't help but gravitate to the business context. But somebody who's kind of pushing you for answers, man, that's when that internal stuff really gets triggered. And that's when you really have to have some internal peace. You have to be relaxed. You have to be calm internally to be able to inside be able to go, hey, this person is really kind of pushing me for an answer. I need to kind of figure out how to let some of that pressure off, help them let the pressure off, say something in a way that helps them get that concern out so then we can have that conversation. Sometimes I realize I've just got to let the customer or the person I'm talking to talk to me for 10 or 15 minutes. I just got to let them get it out. You know, I've pictured it like a balloon that's about to burst. You've got to let some pressure out, some air out of that balloon in order to then be able to put that other person in a frame of mind where together you can figure out a solution. Because most of the times, you don't have an answer. What you have is experience that if you combine it with the other person's situation, together you can come up with a solution. If I call a friend to ask for advice, where, you know, going back to what you started at the top of the show, you know, not unsolicited advice, but solicited advice, where I'm actually making an invitation for my best friend to give me information, I rarely take his information, his advice exactly as he gives it to me. I modify it. I usually will take something here and something there. And sometimes based on the ideas he brings to me, I'll put a third one in there. And that's that idea of coming up with a solution.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I wanted to bring up to the, so I wanted to like, let's move on to business and the specific subject matter, which is, you know, business consulting and business advisory. Let's take all the stuff that we talked about and frame it in a business context. There's an article, and I'll post it in the Facebook video below. There's an article that says, learn how a true trusted advisor, business advisor adds value. It's by Eddie Osborne. And I'm going to read some excerpts from it because I really like the expression that she uses. She uses an expression or a term called random acts of consulting. Okay. And then she's saying here that most accountants and business consultants, well, let's say accountants. I'm going to start with just accountants. Most accountants end up doing this thing that she calls random acts of consulting, which are one-off, you know, on the fly, you know, random questions, unstructured, which the clients ask a question and they feel that immediate need to give an immediate answer. Now, many a times, I will side with the side of the accountant, many a times their experience and their knowledge of the client may drive them to give, I don't want to say the correct answer, but an answer that's helpful or adds value to the client and it allows the client to make a decision, whatever decision they're trying to make. But the vast majority of times, you know, we have a very structured approach to preparing tax returns. We have a very structured approach to doing accounting work. We have a very structured approach to preparing financial statements and forecasts. But there is no such thing as a structured approach for consulting. Now, I'm sure that the big companies like McKinsey and BCG and Bain Capital, all those companies have some sort of quote-unquote structured approach to consulting. But most of us that are doing small business consulting, these structure approaches really, I assume they're great when you're dealing with you know, large verticals and long decision-making protocols and big companies in which you have to convince one group then to convince the other group that creates a spreadsheet that shows the other group the ROI. And it's this whole ordeal to make one decision. Right? One of the beauties that we have as accountants and mostly accountants and IT consultants working for smaller clients is that we don't have these long decision-making structures. And most of the times the answer that we give plays an enormous amount of weight on the decision-making that the client will give. Back to your comment, Kirk, you know, what do we want to give? Do we want to give a fast answer? Do we want to give the quickest answer? Or do we want to give the best answer that we can give? And this is the time that you're saying where the clients are pressing us for answers, maybe during the value conversation, maybe during a proposal stage, maybe when you're just getting started, and the clients are asking questions that require some thought, some process, some testing, even some spreadsheets, you know, it requires some sort of analysis for us to go back and say, you know, after my analysis, after my understanding, these are the options that I think you should consider. But a lot of times, you know, giving this immediate answer falls into this category of random acts of consulting. So what ends up happening is you end up giving an answer to the client immediately that could play a lot of weight. And then if you backtrack it later on because you researched or you realized that maybe you didn't understand the whole context of what they needed, or many a times the clients will ask you a question, which is actually not the question they're asking you. It's just to the best of their ability, how they were able to frame their problem. But at the same time, the problem has nothing to do with the question that they asked. That's just at the moment what they thought that they were asking. And then basically put you in the position to go back and say, you remember that answer I gave you? Well, honestly, I didn't understand what you wanted. Now I have to give you a different answer. And I also have to rephrase your question. And that actually causes a whole bunch of problems. So I think the best advisors probably hold off on giving the advice immediately. But I think there's also another side of the coin, Kirk, which is when we're trying to win the business, and this is something that I'm sure you know a lot of, when we're trying to win that business, we're in a competitive scenario, then most people say, wait, hang on a second, Hector, I can't hold back all my advice because then it sounds like I add no value. So there is sort of a fine line between that sort of immediate advice or that immediate value that we have to give up front, that we have to give something just to show to the client that we understand them, that we understand the industry, that we've been there before, right? And we're giving a little, we're putting a little skin in the game because we want the client and we're giving up a little bit. But there's some sort of fine line between the unsolicited advice, or in this case, you're saying that it's solicited in some cases, but it's this unstructured advice versus a structured advice. And also, I'll ask you to comment on that, but there's another part in the article, and again, I'll put the article in the chat box below, that talks about kind of like her suggestions on how to go about doing that structured advice. So what she says is that we need to break it down into four. She has, you know, fun words for it: hindsight, oversight, insight, and foresight. Okay, she breaks it into four. So for the most part, and this is what accountants are great at doing, is hindsight, right? This is reporting on the past. This is what happened, right? These are the transactions. These are your financial statements. These are the results, right? That's hindsight, okay? So we have to do that first, right? So we have to get that done. And that's not part of the advisory. That's actually the mechanical, technical piece of the accounting work. Then we move to oversight. Now, oversight is when we step back and then we allow the client to create their own hindsight, right? So the client creates their own historical numbers, they create their own databases, they create their own financial statements. And what we do is we take a step back and we basically create those guardrails and those systems. We design IT systems, we design control systems, we write manuals, we give them guidance, we give training so they can create their own hindsight that gives them that real time information. So that's the second step. We move to oversight. Then the third one is insight. Okay, this is when we interpret the data for the client. This is when we have the hindsight from the historical transactions. We have the oversight from the control mechanisms that we created, monitoring systems, reports, whatever. And then we actually are there to say, you see what you're looking at? Look at it this way. You know, take this number divided by that number and then think about that comment that the customer gave you and put all that stuff together and see if that gives you any insight into what's happening with your business and what the numbers are signaling in combination with the other stuff that's happening outside the numbers. Because any computer system can give numerical insight. Only true advisors can give non-numerical insight. So this is where we actually take, you know, the oversighted hindsight numbers and include some outside observations. And then the last one, which is the one where the most value is, and this is the one you can price the highest, and this is the one that you can literally take a piece of the client's benefit, is the foresight. It's what do you do that existentially changes results in the future. So I really, really liked the way that she framed it together in those four: hindsight, oversight, insight, and foresight elements, because it does sort of restructure how you approach advisory. So I wanted to comment on that.
Well, I'm going to back up because there's several things that you mentioned that I want to comment on. I don't think anybody ever accused me of not having an opinion. And the longer your segment goes, the more opinions I have to share when it's my turn. So the first thing, I want to come back to this idea of random acts of consulting, I think is how you expressed it. And I think really in reality, what we're trying to avoid is being random in anything. That we're really trying to avoid doing something without thinking about it and being intentional. So I think I just want to clarify that I would say it may appear random to the customer, but it shouldn't be. It should be intentional on your part. So I guess I'm uncomfortable with the term random unless you know, what the author that you mentioned was saying is, hey, we're just going out there and throwing out advice we shouldn't be throwing out. Okay, I can see consultants doing that, especially, you know, when you don't have an advisory mindset. We talked about that on an earlier episode, but I just kind of wanted to address that idea of random, because that just it language is important, and that term random to me implies something that I don't think is what we're talking about doing.
Well, she just made my mistake on the way I framed it. She's attacking random acts of consulting. She's attacking it, and she's trying to convince the reader that that it shouldn't be random, that it should be structured. So maybe there's a way I framed it. So I apologize for that.
Well, then the author and I are on the same page there, because I don't think anything you do in a business context should be random. I think it should be very intentional. Now, it might appear random to the customer, just because the customer doesn't understand how you're thinking about it behind the scenes. They may not, you know, you may be taking them on a journey. They may not have the map that you have in front of you. So to them, there may be some randomness to it. But yeah, it shouldn't be unintentional or unplanned. That being said, the next thing that I want to mention is Mahan Khalsa has a book that is probably one of the best books available on how to have a value conversation, although he doesn't use that term. And I'm trying to remember, Let's Get Real or Let's Not Play.
Right,
that's the title of the book.
Yeah, Let's Get Real and Not Play at All. Right?
And in the book, he talks about this idea of during the selling process that you want to convey to the customer that the way you sell is an indication of how you solve or how you serve. In other words, that your selling process needs to convey to the customer this idea that you are there for them, you are building rapport, that you're willing to spend some time with them to ask questions, to go through humble inquiry, to have a conversation, and to not assume that, number one, they've already correctly diagnosed the problem, to not assume, number two, that you automatically have the answer because you're the consultant, and you go through a process, and I do think there are processes for consulting. In fact, the author, and I'm going to have to look up the author because I keep referring to his books without mentioning his name, but the book after Humble Inquiry is called Humble Consulting. So it's this idea of taking this idea of humble inquiry and putting it into a business context. So there are processes, and process can be very simple. In fact, my process is fairly simple, but they can be more complex. And a lot of times it depends on, you know, the engagement, the severity or degree of the issue and so forth. And, you know, just the position as to how formal or informal that process is. I think most of our small business advisors can take a very informal process. Now, informal doesn't mean there's no sequence or there's no forethought, but it just means that you don't have to be real rigid about it. Okay. That there's some flexibility there. I like the analogy of the four sights that you talked about. So hindsight, you mentioned, is kind of just the transactional part of the business. You know, it's basically just repairing reports in a sense. Oversight, I think, falls into this idea of, with consultants, true consultants have no decision-making authority. They can advise the customer on what to do or how to do it, or make a recommendation, probably is the best language that I can think of, but they don't make the decision. They make a recommendation, but the customer ultimately makes the decision. If a customer gives the consultant authority, then what that consultant has become, they've become a manager, okay? They've essentially, you know, become a manager for hire, you know, a hired gun in that sense, if the customer truly gives authority to make that decision. Now, I've seen many situations where customers tell the consultant, you have the authority, but you really don't. But the bottom line is, a good consultant doesn't want that authority, okay? Not because they're scared of it, but because they realize ultimately the customer has to make the decision, and they are really about facilitating, guiding, being a Sherpa to the customer. The other two sites that you mentioned, Insight and Foresight, those are the two things where I think we want to focus on with advisory. Insight being looking at historical records and providing new knowledge, new observations based on that. And then also the ability to actually, you know, kind of have a crystal ball in a sense, not to predict the future, but to say, here's what you may encounter next. Your business hasn't gotten to the point that I've seen 10 other businesses get to, and you're going to get to this plateau, or you're going to get to this, you know, if your growth gets over 20%, this is going to happen. Or, you know, you're cooking along fine here at 15% growth year over year. But if that edges up more over 18%, you're going to hit this new step in your business that's going to create. So you need to realize you're growing at a good rate right now, but you could get to a growth rate that's actually going to harm you. You know, those type of things. That's what we're talking about. So lots of thoughts along those lines. But I think it all boils down to the simple idea of humble inquiry. I just want to get back to it. I want to simplify it because I don't think it's that complex. Now, I'm not saying there's not skill. I think there's a lot of skill in learning what questions to ask, how to ask them, how to redirect, how to rephrase, how to re-ask. Those three things right there are huge skills that take a lot of practice. Rephrasing, redirecting, and re-asking. Those are all different ways of bringing the customer back around when they don't answer the question, they don't provide full information, when you feel like you need more information, et cetera. But I think it all boils down to being comfortable asking the question. And as we talked about earlier, first you have to deal with that internal stuff. You need to get to a point where you go, you know what? Asking a question is the best thing I can do.
You know, all philosophical studies, which I believe are extremely important parts of civilization, right? Which is the philosophy where people ask, you know, who we are, where do we come from, what's our purpose in life, the meaning of life. They're all question based, right? I mean, I don't think any philosophers really try to answer the question. I don't think any philosophers are known for telling you the meaning of life, or you know, to be or not to be is a question, right? You know, everything's about, I believe that the right questions can trigger a lot more behavior change, a lot more different decision making, and paradigm shifts than an authoritative statement or rule. There's some, for example, let me give you an example of like a day-to-day technique that I use. Like for some clients will come to me and says, hey, I'm going to go to XYZ concert. You know, is this tax deductible? Then I can give a single answer like no, right? And that's, I think most accountants just want to say that, just no, right? But I could also give them a different question saying, hey, do you feel comfortable sitting in front of a tax judge justifying the business need for you to go to that concert and explaining what business you closed during the concert and the specific client that you were dealing with the concert, and also kind of explain more or less why you couldn't do that in a Starbucks. And then the client goes, ah, you know what? Then I answer my own question. And basically those questions stop happening because we made them answer their own question by giving them back the same question with inquiry. And but this is not easy to do, by the way. It's like if you're trying to impress a client on your very first meeting where the client is trying to hire you for your, you know, tax planning prowess. Did I say that correctly? Prowess?
Works for me.
Right. For your tax planning prowess, they're going to want you, or we think that the answer that we want, that they want is, well, according to section, 62 of the code, 62B-1, there's a couple of loopholes here. Clients, for the most part, that's not the answer they're looking for. They're trying to connect with you in a human level, and they want to see that the way you approach it is not just mechanical and the way the government would, like that you would sort of go to bat for them in those sort of gray areas of tax planning. And some questions that normally I would say immediately, no, that's not deductible. You know, with the inquiry, the client will go back and say, well, you know, let me explain to you where I'm coming from. And they'll kind of explain the whole situation. You're like, well, you know, that's, you know, when you frame it that way, and if you have the documentation and you feel comfortable you know, defending yourself against, you know, an auditor, you know, using that framing, then yes, well, let's take that position and we'll make it deductible. You know, so that's actually a really, you know, so it's, I just thinking of a very day-to-day mundane way to turn humble inquiry into a statement, actually advisory statement, without me actually saying yes or no, giving the client the power of choice, like they chose, but they could have Googled it. They could have read the code themselves. You know, technically, could they have found that answer online? Maybe, but it is that unique relationship that we have that allows, that gives me permission to ask the question the way I asked it and frame it in a way that the client understands it so that we can shape their mindset. And I think that's the incredible hidden value of a trusted advisor that you have a relationship with, is how they frame things to you, how they frame their questions. The other piece that I think is extremely valuable is something that has helped me more as a salesperson than as an advisor, is when you ask questions, you have to always think that there's sort of limited real estate on the client's head for questions. Like you said, sometimes your clients will say, why are you asking me so many questions? Or why are you asking me questions about that? Aren't you the expert? I think there is a limit to the number of questions that a client feels comfortable with. There's a point in time where the client goes, you know, I really want you to go somewhere with this, right? I mean, I think we can agree to that. Like, I think on, you know, ask as many questions as possible. I'll make a blanket statement. All questions are good, or questions, whether they're naive or humble or whatever approach, they're all good. They're all fair game. But there is an attention span problem. The client will get frustrated after X amount of questions, and every client will be different. But as a salesperson, having knowledge of that the client's going to have a limited amount of real estate in their head that in which they can allow me to ask questions and actually give me answers for, I have to be intentional and pick the right questions that allow me to frame my sell in the future. In other words, if I'm asking questions at the beginning about how the client behaves, they're not just for chit chat. You know, I am going to use some of their answers to then present a solution, to present an option, to present a choice. You know, if I ask a client a key question that you have to ask, if you're an accounting professional, you're watching this, this is the single most important question that I've learned how to ask the last couple of years, which is, when you have a question for me, how quickly do you demand an answer? Yeah, and that's a simple question. And the client will say, well, I demand an answer within the hour, okay? Then you know that you're probably not gonna price this client for less than $15,000 a month. Why? Because they're pretty much treating you like an employee, saying that you need to be available within the hour, correct? You know, if they say, oh, I demand an answer within 2 weeks, or if they give you the nuance, they say, well, if it's a tax question, I expect the answer by the end of the year. If it's a bookkeeping question, I want it by the end of the month. If it's a question about purchasing a car or a vehicle and I'm sitting at the dealership, I would love for you to answer immediately. So if the client gives you sort of that nuanced answer, then you take that information, and that's how you shape your advisory services, and that's how you price them, that's how you scope them, saying, hey, the advisory service that you chose includes me being accessible in so much time, or someone else from my team giving you a generic answer and give me at least 48 hours to give you my second opinion. I mean, so you can use these questions and weaponize them. I know you like that word when I used that earlier. In another episode, we can weaponize them and turn them into scope package for our pricing and deciding what the relationship would look like. So you mentioned being intentional about your questions, and that's what I was thinking. I wanted to comment on that.
So again, you pack a lot of wisdom into your segments. And so several things that I want to add my two cents on. First of all, I want to distinguish between this idea of when you're asking questions and a client is resistive to answering the questions because they just want you to have an answer, or they're simply wanting you to be a set of hired hands. We're talking about a situation where you realize the customer, you want to act as a consultant because you believe that is the best way to help the customer, but the customer is not approaching you as a consultant. They don't see you as a consultant. They see you in a different role. They see you as an answer man or a hired set of hands, etc. In those situations, you do have to press into that resistance. And, you know, I literally have had, and that's what I was referring to earlier when I talked about customers going, why are you asking all these questions? Well, when they respond that way, and I know it's coming from a point of resistance to my approach, at that point, it's a question of, is this really a good professional customer relationship? And so I'll go, look, I don't assume to know what's going on in your situation. Every situation that I encounter is different. And so I start off with questions that I need you to share with me so that I come at this with a fresh set of eyes. Most of the time, I'd say a little, you know, over half customers are receptive to that. But sometimes they go, no, I'm a printing company. If you worked with five other printing companies, we're all the same. And it's at that point, you know, we've hit a fundamental difference of viewpoint. We're really in our belief system, right? They've got a core belief that their printing business is like five others. And I've got a core belief, no, every situation's unique. And in order to help the customer and not do harm, I've got to understand the unique situation. So I'm distinguishing between a customer who's resistive versus what you described, I think, which is simply a customer that's tired, right? I mean, this type of interaction that we're describing, humble inquiry, it requires a lot of energy, both on the part of the consultant and on the part of the customer. And I think it is part of a sign of experience and professionalism and maturity, not age maturity, but maturity in the skill of humble inquiry to go, you know what, we've been on the phone for 30 minutes, 45 minutes. Let's have another conversation. Can we get back on the phone tomorrow or the next day? And I do that a lot of times. I think you've got to be perceptive as to which are you working with. Are you working with a customer who's resistive or a customer who's getting low in energy? And you have to make that distinction. So I kind of wanted to unpack that. The second thing I wanted to do is I wanted to go back. You know, you were talking about this idea of the customer who says, is the concert tax deductible, right? And so you kind of took it to the next level up, which is teaching them how to make their own assessment of whether it's deductible, right? Let me propose, and I'm not saying that you need to do this in lieu of what you did. I'm saying this would be a way to take it a step further. Once you've taught them how to, you know, determine on their own if it's deductible, then I would go, how come you're so concerned about it being deductible, right? Why? Because in my experience, and I think most accountants would agree with this, you can only cut costs so far, right? To me, whether something's deductible, that's coming from a viewpoint of, you know, kind of cost cutting, right? And there have been numerous studies that show that, you know, a 1% increase in price can lead to as much as a 10% increase in net profit. So it's much, and you're not going to get those same kind of returns usually on cost cutting, not on a regular basis. You might on a first, maybe a second round, but beyond that, no. Why do they have another way to phrase it would be when I hear that question, I want to go, okay, is this customer operating from a mentality, a poverty mentality or an abundance mentality, right? I think an abundance mentality says, well, we just need to increase prices or we need to find a way to deliver more value to justify increasing prices. I think a scarcity really is the opposite of abundance. Scarcity mentality, this idea of, we just need to cut. So I, you know, and maybe that's not there, but it's an idea for me. The question that popped in my mind when you came with that example is, well, why is the customer so freaking concerned about, you know, whether something's deductible or not, right? I mean, have they been audited before? And so they're scared of an audit. Do they know they're pushing the line? I mean, is there an ethic, you know, is that an indication of possibly, you know, on the customer's part, maybe they're pushing an ethical boundary they have? I don't know that. And we can unpack all that earlier, but that just was a whole nother area of inquiry that you could take this to and, again, put yourself in more of a consulting role. So I think there was a question you asked me at the end of your last segment. I don't even remember what it was, but if there's something I didn't respond to, let me know. I'll be happy to.
Yeah, my question is going to a concert tax deductible? No, I think we can do a whole episode on just using those type of like tax type of inquiries. To understand, I mean, I think we can do a whole segment on understanding these tax deductibility inquiries, where they're coming from and what the real intent is, and also how tax shapes behavior. That's a whole nother conversation we can talk about, you know, why government uses tax to shape behavior and how that in turn can change the behavior of our clients and our attitude towards, you know, how we do work with them can change. Like, for example, let's assume for a second that the tax code, and this is not the case, said that all consulting is not tax deductible. You know, how would that existentially change our career as advisories and as advisors and consultants? You know, so that's an interesting one. So, or the government said, well, consulting is only tax deductible if it delivers results, if you can prove that it delivers results. How would that change the behavior of the client towards buying consulting services? And how would their expectations change in terms of, well, if I'm doing this also because it's tax deductible, I'm also thinking that I have to get some sort of result. You know, going back to the concert question and your abundance and scarcity question is, look, if you're going to take your best client to a concert and you're going to close $1 million business, who cares if it's deductible or not? You know, and if you do close the business, why do you even have to ask whether it's deductible or not? I mean, that's kind of like the question. And I think that a lot of times we're going to save this for another episode, but is this deductible question, it indicates two things. One, it probably isn't deductible because they're bringing it out into the open. When clients almost know what's legitimately business expense, and they never say, hey, when I go to Office Depot and I buy print, when I buy paper and ink, is that deductible? I never get that question magically, you know, which is interesting. So it's only the stuff that they know is not straightforward business that they ask. And there's a lot of potential behavior shaping that we can do with our clients. I'm going to give you an example that is going to resonate in 2018, and it's going to resonate big time. The new tax code, and you've been wanting me to talk about the new tax code for a while. So I'll give you a little bit hint on this. We'll give you a little taste of that. The new tax code, which gave a lot of tax breaks for small business, did take away one big gray area tax deduction, which is entertainment. And they added so much gray area around meals, but entertainment. So the question of concerts and stuff. So entertainment in itself is something that's no longer tax deductible. So that means that some of my clients, and not that many of them, that used to take their clients to like strip joints, right? Because it's entertainment, will probably no longer do that because it's no longer deductible. And what kind of behavior is the tax code shaping? Or what if I make a big deal? Because I don't, you know, I have to tell my clients, dude, don't take your clients to strip joints anymore because it's not going to be tax deductible. Whereas, you know, it would have been good advice anyway to tell them not to do it in the first place. But now I have the weapon of tax deductibility or non-deductibility to use it. So we can actually shape behaviors even with the tax code to our advantage. And I've been in many cases where I keep telling my clients to get a new computer system because their bookkeeper is complaining that it takes forever for them to print a check. And they're too cheap to buy a new computer because they say, oh, that's fine. So I come back and say, hey, you know, this year there's going to be a huge deduction on new computers. You should buy them. And they go, okay, and they buy the computer. It's the same deduction. Nothing changed. But just using tax deductibility in your framework can induce some behavior. Not that I do that. I've never intentionally asked my client to do that. But what I'm saying is you can even use this whole tax code to even shape or incentivize the behaviors that you want your client to have as a consultant. Although it's not your call to tell them how to act, but in some cases, if they're asking you for advice, changing their behaviors may come as part of the advice.
I think great consulting can be defined as helping the customer make better decisions. Better decisions means they make a better decision because of the interaction with you than they would have made on their own. To me, that is the ultimate definition of great consulting. Again, the customer gets to make the decision. We're just simply in a place of helping them. And by the way, speaking of helping, I said I wanted to give out the name of the author. So I've referred to three books. They're all by Edgar Schein, S-C-H-E-I-N. The first one is Helping, How to Offer, Give, and Receive Help. The second one, Humble Inquiry, The Gentle Art of Asking Instead of Telling. And then the third one, Humble Consulting, How to Provide Real Help Faster. And just by point of clarification, I'm currently reading the second one, and that's how I found out about the other two. So I have not read all three of them, although I do have them on my list. So again, helping the customer make better decisions, I think, is the definition of consulting. The other thing that this idea of humble inquiry does, and I touched on it earlier, but I want to come back to it since you kind of brought up this area of, you know, are taking clients to strippers entertainment. See, if I had a client who asked me that, I would just simply say, you know what, I think we might not be a fit, because there's a philosophy there's an underlying belief there. And I'm not passing judgment on you. Since you brought it up, I want to use it as an opportunity to say, part of what humble inquiry is going to do, it's going to help you help the customer disqualify themselves. Okay. I most of the time a customer winds up telling me we're not a fit, and I'm fine with that, because I would rather the customer tell me, because I've got thick skin and I'm okay hearing that. 9 times out of 10, when they say it, I've already been thinking it. I've just been trying to help them come to that resolution. Because for me to tell the customer we're not a fit is insulting. It's, again, that idea of I'm telling, and in that case, you're telling something that can be very offensive. There's hardly any way to sugarcoat that. But if they come to the conclusion, and you know it's the right conclusion, and you're actually anticipating, expecting it, leading them there, then, you know, you're helping them. I actually believe that part of humble inquiry, part of being a great consultant, is being okay with the customer saying no. And no can be, no, I don't want to work with you. No can be, no, I don't want to take your recommendation. I'm happy if I have a 45-minute conversation with a customer and the outcome of it is they realize they don't need what they thought they needed, or they don't need me, or they need to seek somebody else, or we're not a fit. I'm okay with that. And that's one of the things that you'll find in multiple books, whether it's Humble Inquiry, Let's Get Real, Let's Not Play, etc. You'll find that idea going throughout.
So, yeah, I'll answer one thing, though. So there are challenges. So if a client does something that's illegal, I will immediately drop them and not take them. And so I'll make that a statement right up front. If they're doing something that's legal and immoral, because I think you're talking about somehow you were hinting on that. Sometimes they just don't have time to give people moral advice. So I can either just simply answer the question or try to, I mean, look, there are some areas in which morality can cross the line, and I would do that. But this stuff is, it actually happens a lot more often than you think. For some of these successful small business guys that are trying to impress out of towners or whatever, you know, some of these things happen. And for me to like sit there and try to pass judgment on each one, it's just way too tiring. So I could do that, but you know, for me, it's just, I think, by the way, I disagree with it. Like, I don't think that is a place to conduct business in the first place. Like, it's hard to conduct business when there's so much distractions, let's call it that. However, people have different ways that they bond with each other. Like, we're talking about the connection between two people that do businesses. Like, I like to take my clients, the ones that like to golf, I like to golf with them. Or a business partner, I like to golf with them. You know, I'm sure that someone out there in this country will find golfing to be immoral for whatever reason, right? Using too much land, or it's for rich people, whatever. So I try not to play too much into that, or at least I used to before. I used to be a lot more, let's call it, activist. But now, like at the beginning, you know, I used to say, I don't want to deal with people that are against my political beliefs, because, you know, political beliefs are so contested nowadays. And I just learned to just have fun with it. Like, and I have tons of deep political discussions with people that believe the opposite of what I believe in, with current administration, past administration. But I try to do it in a way in which I pass my opinion in a subjective way. I use the facts that I know and understand. And like you said, you know, how we talk to our clients, how we bring them in, how we ask questions can tell a lot about what the interaction will look like. What would the work look like? You know, how responsible are we going to be at delivering a result? You know, how responsive we're going to be. That conversation you have at the beginning can shape that whole thing. And you're right, a client that on the very first interaction is trying to, you know, is bringing in a whole bunch of morally line-crossing scenarios, and you're really not comfortable with that stuff, I think it's just much better to just say, no, you know what? I like to work with clients that are more conservative. Let's just call it that. And you can always use that word because most people hire accountants for being aggressive, not conservative. Believe it or not, they want to hear that their accountant is aggressive. Like, that's the word that they want. He's aggressive. And when you use the word, I'm very conservative, it will turn off those clients that like to cross that line or like to live in the edge of that gray area. So you can simply, just by using that word, you can, like you said, they can disqualify themselves. But once I take on the client and I know that 95% of what they do is within, you know, what I'm okay with, you know, one of these one-offs, I wouldn't drop them right away. Although, you know, I'm actually a very moral person. So if a client is against the values of my company, I tend to believe that caving in will somehow jeopardize the values of your company as well. And it could bring in some negative stuff to your team and stuff like that. But, you know, on the case of being objective, you know, I can use things like the tax code and say, according to the tax code, probably not. And hopefully that behavior changes just because it's not tax deductible. So I wanted to give my comment on your comment about my comment.
Well, what all that sounded like is a advertisement for a future topic on being ethical, moral, and objective. And I would love to have that conversation, both in the context of pricing and outside it, because I actually have a presentation. It's an hour-long presentation that I do on the ethics of pricing. So I think there's definitely a future conversation there for us. But as we wrap this episode up, this has been a great conversation. And if I can say, I think these conversations are getting better. I think you and I are getting better at having them. This was a great topic. And right now, Hector is coming up with most of our topics. I like to show up and just see what he's going to throw at me. So far, I'm not scared away. So I guess that's a good thing. In other words, I still have opinions to share. Anyway, if you have any input on it for us, either of us, a question or a comment about how we can do the show better, a topic you'd like for us to include, reach out to us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/artofadvisory. We'd love to hear from you. Again, we do this episode live every Tuesday, but we'd also love for you to watch the recordings if that's not convenient for you. Hector, I'll see you next week.
I'll see you next week, Kirk.